from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll take a peek at the upcoming annual Stutz Artist Open House.
I'll get a preview of next year's Broadway and Indianapolis touring company season.
And I'll polish up on my knowledge of silver with a new IMA exhibit. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. If you've driven by the former Stutz Motor Car Factory at 11th and Capitol and always wanted to see inside, well, your chance is coming up on April 24th and 25th. The Stutz building will be open for its annual open house, with a party scene on Friday night and a more relaxed atmosphere on Saturday. And Sharon Gamble invited organizers Martha Vaught and Rich Hanna to tell her about this year's events.
Martha, how long have you been at the Stutz now? How long have you had a studio there?
This April will mark my 8th year at the Stutz. So that was, what, 2007 or 2006 I started there.
And how long have you participated in the open house?
All those years. And we moved in, I think, 2 weeks before the first open house and scrambled to get it all together. It was very exciting. And it was back in the day, Jerry Points and Mike Schwalski were heading it up, and they mentored us in very efficiently. They were astounded that we could get ready that quickly.
That's impressive.
Now I start in September.
Well, now, wait a minute. How do you account for that?
Starting in September?
No, yeah.
To get ready to produce artwork? It takes a while. Yeah, you begin to get increasingly anxious by Christmas era. We're kind of in a panic to get, because there is so much to do, just getting work finished and your own promotionals and then volunteering with the association. There's plenty to do.
And you're a co-organizer this year, so extra. What all, I'm guessing that means you're away from your studio more than is ideal, but what kinds of things are you doing?
No, I work from my studio with the other artists. There are several of us, of course, on the committee. It's my second year as co-organizer. Janet Marie Braun is the other artist organizer. We, of course, we work with our PR person. We work with our executive director and event coordinator, Kathy Wineland, putting together, designing the event. You know, what are we going to do new? What are we going to do different? And all the logistics, of course, there. You know, how do we... What do we want to make people come see?
Yeah. And Rich, you're a committee member, and I understand you've been working on some of those new wrinkles for this year.
Yes.
What sorts of things are new?
Well, what we have decided to do this year is have artist demonstrations. And for a while, we thought of having it at a single place where the artists would come and demonstrate at a location. That really doesn't work out well with the way most people work out of their studios for that
Because
that
of
weekend.
Equipment. And,
right, yeah. So we're going to have them in the individual artist studios, but they'll be on Saturday afternoon this year. We're trying to make Saturday a little more family-friendly. And so that we've got 7 artists lined up that will give demonstrations in their studios about every half hour, starting about 2:30 and then running.
What
the rest of the day?
What mediums?
Quite a variety. We've got Rachel Steele, who's a traditional oil painter, and she'll be demonstrating how to layer paints and get translucence in her paints. We've got Kerry Jackson, who's a performance artist, among other things. So he'll be creating a painting to live music in the hallway outside of his studio. Then we've got Wendy Franklin, who's a fabric artist, and she'll be demonstrating wet felting, how you layer wool and silk together and mesh them together. Myra Perrin makes metal, so she'll be demonstrating how to use flat copper and wire to make three-dimensional things and also add texture and color to the metal. Cheryl Lawrence is going to be giving a demonstration in egg tempera, which is one of the most ancient forms of painting, was predominant in medieval and early Renaissance Europe until about 1500, when oil painting became much more popular. But she'll be giving a demonstration on that. I work mainly in wax, both hot and cold wax, so I'll be giving a demonstration in caustic and also cold wax. And then we've got some quilters, a studio called Quilting by the Stitch, several members of the Clayton family who'll be doing just showing how they take fabric and make a traditional quilt box block and then turn that into something looking very contemporary.
That's a really wonderful range of demonstrations.
I'm excited by it. Yeah. A really nice variety of different types of artists.
And as you point out, appropriate for anybody of any age, but especially if you're trying to get your kids to understand how that art that maybe they've been on a field trip, they've gone to a museum, or you've taken them to a gallery on First Friday or Second Saturday or whatever, but to actually see how stuff gets made.
Yes, yeah, that's really what we're trying to get that connection, that involvement with people to see how not only what it looks like in this the finished project, but how it gets there.
Yeah.
Yes, and the ticket, you can come on Friday night, and with your stub, you can have admission again on Saturday. It is a little. We really are trying to make it family friendly. There will be a scavenger hunt with an art project for the young people
on Saturday.
On Saturday, ooh, as well. So, and especially for the people that get there in time, our title sponsor Raymond James has on the third floor free ice cream.
Oh,
they. Donate some of the proceeds from that to scholarships to Heron Saturday School. So they are a very active partner in not only our event but in arts.
For people who might not be familiar, what is Heron Saturday School?
It is a program, and I believe it's the art ed majors that teach it that are going to be art teachers. They have classes for, I think it's 13 to the 18-year-olds through mm-hmm. the secondary and high school or high school age kids on Saturday. I don't have a lot of direct information about it, but I'm sure they do on their website.
Sure. For people who maybe moved to town and haven't been recently and haven't been to the Stutz Artists Open House, it's not that Friday night is family unfriendly, if there is such an explanation, but describe the scene on Friday night. It's one of the most energetic and energizing events that happens throughout the year.
Well, the hallways are full of people. There's live music. Our headliner this year will be Andrea Fay and the Rayheads and Bearcats Alley. There are antique vintage cars throughout the building and especially in the car room. It's a giant rabbit warren of a building. There's 400,000 square feet. We have around 70 artists and several businesses that are open. A lot of what draws people is it's a chance to come in and see not only the artwork, but where the artwork is made. And that is very interesting, and you get to directly talk to the artist about their work. And in the 8 years that I've been there, and even on Friday when it's really a party atmosphere with food and drinks, the people I'm engaging with each year are more sophisticated about visual art, and they are asking better questions.
Wow.
And I have found, Indianapolis really, right now, we are exploding with visual art venues and scenes. So I am impressed that it is reaching an audience, a growing audience.
I know the Stutz Art Center, when it started, it's not the only one of its kind in the world, but it was kind of a risk for Turner Woodard and mm-hmm. company to try, and it's kind of like an incubator for artists. Rich, tell me what attracted you to take a studio there.
I'd been someone who for years had gone to the open house, so I was certainly aware that there were a lot of artists there. And as I was finishing up my degree at Heron in December 2010, I was looking around for a studio space, and someone advertised through Heron that they were looking for someone to share a space with, and I jumped at the opportunity. That was... I figured probably I'd get a studio somewhere else and work my way up to being in the Stutz building. Mm-hmm. So it was a thrill to be able to jump in there right away.
Were you working out of your home before, or what were you? Where were you?
I briefly had a studio in the Bodner Building, the Madison Avenue studios, mm-hmm. that went back to being an office building as it had been before. So lost those studios. But mainly out of my home, yes, prior to getting the studio at the Stutz.
Why is it important to be able to work in a space that's not your home?
My wife is very organized. She's a librarian, and I am not. And those two sometimes don't mix in an art studio. And it's best that I have a space that it's not that she's not allowed there, but I'm just more comfortable setting it up the way I work, which sure. is more intuitive and not organized to someone who might look at it.
I don't know, Rich.
Way.
I've been by your studio. It looks very much more organized than
my first 4 years, I was in the Stutz II building in a small studio that I shared. And just last November, I moved into a larger space in the main building. And I think it looks organized now because I haven't been there long enough.
So give him time is what he's saying, Martha.
Yep.
Stop by again in 6 months. So I can see the future Stutz ads for marital harmony, relationship harmony. Get out of your garage, get out of your spare bedroom and get a studio here. And you had a circuitous path to your art.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, actually, I mean, I drew and painted for as long as I can remember. And I grew up in Pittsburgh. And as a middle school child, I was recommended by a middle school teacher for Saturday morning classes at the Carnegie Museum there.
Wow.
They call them Tam O'Shanter classes. And they've been going on for a long time. Their most famous alumni for those Saturday morning classes were Philip Perlstein and Andy Warhol.
Oh,
so I went
good
to
company
same,
to be
yeah,
in.
Same Saturday classes. Not at the same time, obviously. My parents encouraged me in the arts all the way through grade school and high school. But when I went to go to college, they sat me down and said, arts are very all well and good for kids, but you're an adult now, and so that's it. And I was stunned. I'd always defined myself as an artist. So I had a very circuitous route back to the arts over the a long period of time. I spent 20 years as a freelance writer covering auto racing. Before I finally came back to going back to school and getting a degree and getting a studio and getting back into the arts.
So you figured out a way to keep the creativity in your
yes,
career.
Yeah.
And in your
yeah, somehow I managed to get a degree in theater in there somewhere too. So.
Martha, you had a more straightforward path, right?
Yes. Again, my mother decided that I would be an artist and encouraged me from the get-go. And then I went to Heron. Graduated from night school at Howe High School. Jim Lynch was my teacher, and he said, you know, you should go. You love this. You should go ahead and make up her portfolio. And I got into Heron, and I graduated in 87, and it was just a great time to be at Heron. We had really engaged instruction. Martha Wine and Slaughter was our gallery director at the time. We had international artists coming in and lecturing all the time. Peter Plagans, the former critic at Newsweek. And it, you know, loved it, love artists, love art myself. It's part of the reason I give a good bit of time to the association is because artists need support. They need venues and we need a way to connect with the artists, with audience. And the open house really does do that. There will be over 70 artists, as I said before, and such an astonishing array of styles, materials, and prices. So we really encourage people to come out and start their collections.
Absolutely.
You know, and this is work that's produced right here in Indianapolis. This is our culture being manufactured on site.
By local.
We go to our studios, and this creates a space where we can be focused on our art in a world that's very complicated and confusing a lot of times. You know, you're balancing home and work and family. So we, not only is it just having the studio there as a designated workspace where we can hole away, but it's also a chance to communicate with other artists, spend time with other artists, and see other artists' art being made, which is really a wonderful thing.
It's really one of the biggest attractions to me to being in the Stutz is there's so many other artists there that you can walk around and engage other artists almost all the time, and that's really important for just building ideas and keeping your mind in where you are in the arts.
And as I said, when we were getting ready to graduate at Heron, they were saying, "Well, you know, where are you going to go? Chicago, L.A., or New York?" Because there really isn't a community here to support you, and you'll have to have that. And I believe now Indianapolis does have it to a large degree. I married a farmer, so going out of state was not a question. I mean, you can't pack a farm up and go somewhere
well,
else.
Well, we're lucky you did. You yes. stayed and helped to create the scene that we have now.
Yes, and you know, so many, and like our, we part of the proceeds from Open House fund two studios that are awarded by merit to our resident, we call our residents, one of which is Cheryl Lawrence, our egg temper artist. And, you know, the quality of our residents over the years, they're really very high quality. They're first quality artists. These are not Sunday painters. These people are professionals, if you can use that term for an artist, since it is a vocational. this is a vocation, really, more than a profession. But the quality of the art being made at the Stutz is high, as it is throughout Indianapolis. There's so many different places you can go and see something interesting.
Sharon Gamble with Stutz Artists Open House, co-organizer Martha Vaught and committee member Rich Hanna. You can see their art and that of more than 70 of their colleagues at the two-day event, Friday, April 24th. The show goes from 5:30 to 10:30, and then on Saturday, the 25th, it runs from 2 to 7. Your Friday ticket allows you to come back on Saturday, and Saturday is a good day to bring the kids because there will be lots of hands-on art activities, a scavenger hunt, and ice cream. You can learn more at stutzartists.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. A holiday circus, flying monkeys, Irish love stories, newspaper boys, crashing chandeliers, and more make up the just-announced 2015-2016 Broadway in Indianapolis touring show season. Travis DiNicola spoke with Broadway Across America's Matthew Porter to find out more.
Matthew, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Broadway in Indianapolis is always so much fun. All the great shows that you guys bring, touring shows each year to both Clues and the Marat. I always look forward to finding out what the upcoming schedule is, and we've got the schedule. So it's officially out now, and it is a fun one. Talk me through this. This is for the 2015-2016 series of shows, both at Old National Center at Murat and Clues Memorial Hall, and just a fun, kind of a little bit of something for everyone, right?
There is something for everyone. We're coming off of a season that was programmed very family-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Familiar titles like Annie and Joseph and of course, we have Dirty Dancing still to come.
Sure.
But we really focused on family and education last season. This season, we're really looking for, you know, the shows that are, you know, the new shows that are coming and going on
something
tour.
Something old, something new, something
and
blue.
And something woo, yeah. So we have coming, just announced today, Cirque Dreams Holidays. We have The Wizard of Oz, Once the Musical, Disney's Newsies, and the Phantom of the Opera. Mm-hmm. And those are all part of the five show subscription package.
Okay.
And then we're bringing back, by popular demand, the Book of Mormon for 1 week.
Awesome.
And that will be not on subscription, but will be available to subscribers first.
Okay, cool. So very fun series. Let's talk through what you've got. The Cirque Dreams Holidays. This is in December 2015, be kicking off the season. This sounds really cool. It's like a Cirque show, but with Santa and snowmen and gingerbread men. And
yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. It's so this past season, we brought in Elf over the holidays. We don't always have the opportunity to bring in holiday shows.
Mm-hmm.
They have very short lifespans, so it always depends on what's available. So when we had the opportunity to bring in another holiday show, Elf was so successful here.
Awesome. It was really cool that Santa was a local guy.
That always helps.
Yeah.
And we've actually been very lucky this season with many of our shows having mm-hmm. local talent. So
nice.
So here we go, Indiana.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
So Cirque Dreams Holidays is a Cirque-style show.
Mm-hmm.
This producer, Neil Goldberg, he really likes to create these things for proscenium theater and not for, you know, the big tent arena style.
Okay.
So it's more theatrical. And we're talking about 30 acrobats from around the world who do all kinds of, you know, skillful, amazing things. But this show will be more themed, of course, to Christmas.
Yeah.
And there are the gingerbread men and there's mm-hmm. Santa and all those fun things. So this is a really great family-friendly option for kids of all ages to grandparents and beyond. So,
very cool. And it's more sort of a spectacle, spectacular type
yeah.
show, not so much of a storyline or
no,
something.
No. It's just pure eye candy.
Nice.
It's pure eye candy.
Very fun. That sounds very cool. And then an old classic, but with some new twist to it, Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz, yes. So we know Indianapolis loves their Wicked.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
We always talk about the backstory to the Wizard of Oz. So we've decided to finally bring the Wizard of Oz. This is a new production that's out. And if you remember from the film, it starts out with some music. She sings Over the Rainbow.
Right.
And it goes into Munchkin Land, come out, come out. And then the music just stops throughout the movie. So what Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice decided to do was to get involved with this project and create new songs for the rest of the show. And those songs from the movie are also going to be in there.
So the ones we expect, but a whole bunch of new ones.
Yep.
And, what a great team. I mean, Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber to put together new songs for Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, that's a big stamp of approval for this one.
Yeah.
We're also in the process right now of auditioning for Toto. So I'll keep you updated on who gets cast in that role.
There could be a local dog. You never know.
You never know.
You never know. Once is coming in February, and this will be at Clues. And this is the 2012 Tony Award winning musical about an Irish musician, right?
Yes. A Dublin street musician who is kind of down on his luck and just been through a bad breakup.
It was based on a movie. Right?
A 2008, I believe, Academy Award winner.
Mm-hmm.
And the song Falling Slowly that came from that, of course, is a part of this. And it really is a haunting melody that's through the entire show.
Yeah.
But it's the street musician kind of loses that song.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to give up. And he finds this quirky Czech immigrant who turns him around and says, play for me. Work for me. I want to help you find that again. And then this very complicated romance forms, and without giving too much away, it's just a very bittersweet, lovely show. Everyone that leaves the show will leave with some sort of emotion, and they'll all be different. So
nice.
Yeah, but we're excited to be bringing that that Tony Award winner along with Newsies.
Newsies.
Coming up next.
Yeah. So Newsies, super fun show. Also Tony Award winner. This is going to be at March at Clues. Big show. Kids, music, dance.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome stuff.
Yeah. So Disney, of course, does not, pulls out the stops for everything. So
right.
We're looking forward to having the tour here. The show, when it went to Broadway right after pre-Broadway, was not expected to live very long.
Mm-hmm.
And then lived a couple years. They were, ecstatic.
It was also based on a movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was based on the movie in the early 90s.
Yeah, I remember
Christian
that.
Bale.
Right. And
it was
set in,
popular.
Like, the Depression and, like, kids running around. And
newspaper,
the,
yeah. And it's
fighting
based
the man
the,
in the newspaper business and
yeah,
stuff.
The 1899 newspaper strike. The newspaper boys stood up against Pulitzer and formed their first newspaper boy union. So it's historical. But the movie was a flop at the box office. And it's the number one or what? Was the number one requested movie to take to the stage from fans.
Interesting.
So they did it. They didn't think it was going to really happen, and it took
off. Became crazy popular.
And it's incredible. The choreography alone is incredible. So
really high energy stuff.
Yep. It's big Broadway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of big Broadway, it doesn't get much bigger than Phantom of the Opera, and you guys are bringing Phantom of the Opera back, but it's a new production with some new staging, new sets.
Yes.
So even if you've seen it before, you can still see it again.
You will want to see this version again.
Okay.
Because there have been innovations in lighting and technology and staging and costumes since the show came about 30 years ago.
Yeah, sure.
So what they've done is they've really just fine-tuned it. So little things like the mechanics of the chandelier, which is probably the best known character of the show.
Right, that was like such a big deal 30 years ago. It was gosh. And
it
of course,
still is. It still is.
And the technology, as you said, has changed a lot for theater to be able to do those things on stage. So.
When the tour was last here in Indianapolis, I believe 12 years ago, and it was the old tour before it went and retired, this chandelier has taken, this trip from being a rickety, and I hate to say that, but it was just, it was really something that was really starting to become dated into a spectacular explosion on stage. So people that are really waiting for that chandelier to drop and crash, they're going to really...
Updated special effects. Yeah.
They're in for a surprise, yeah, and they're in for a treat.
Nice. And new costumes and staging, as I said, but it's still the expected story and songs and
people
have loved, but just cleaned up a bit.
And we encourage people to go to our Facebook page. We'll have videos posted.
Hmm.
Really, take a look at it, because it's really hard to say, especially to those purists, that, you're trying to say Phantom of the Opera's been updated, and people mm-hmm. are out there screaming right now saying, no! Right. Nothing really has been changed to the story at all.
Okay.
It's really just the visual that's been updated.
Again, so these are the shows that are part of the regular season for season subscribers for Broadway in Indianapolis.
Yep.
Cirque Dreams Holidays, The Wizard of Oz, Once, Disney's Newsies, and Phantom of the Opera. But then you've got one other add-on, which is you're bringing back Book of Mormon. Book of Mormon was here about a year ago, sold out, crazy popular. I missed it. I can't wait to see it. I'm so glad you guys are bringing it back. You're bringing it back for 1 week in April next year, and that's going to be a lot of fun. This is just a crazy, farcical, goofy show that what makes everyone uncomfortable offends everyone and everyone loves. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we were just talking about that. So the gentleman from South Park, the writers from South Park, put this show together. And yes, you sit through the first part of the show and you wait to see the older folks and when they get offended. And not all of them do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to see who stays through the show to really get the message. And the message is so important. Because it, regardless of what your religious beliefs are, the message fits everyone's kind of, outlook on being a better person and believing in something to make a difference. So
cool.
it really hits home. It really is a spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
The music, the choreography, everything is just, top-notch Broadway. And absolutely hysterical. So
very cool. Now, how do you guys go about picking the shows? Because I know there's a lot of options. You have to figure out, of course, the timing of what's available and when the spaces are available at the Old National Center or Clues. But you're also looking at what have been shows that have been requested, past favorites.
All
a lot
of
goes
the
into
above,
that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, all of the above. And we take our subscriber surveys to heart.
Mm-hmm.
We survey our subscribers every year. We survey our single ticket buyers and. We ask those questions. What do you want to see? What do you like to see? What would you like to see again? We even present questions like, if we were to bring something back like this, would you be mm-hmm. willing to see it? And we take all of those to heart. I mean, it's important to – you cannot please everyone.
Sure.
But over the span of 2 to 3 years, you can at least most people. So
yeah.
We spend a lot of time doing that, working with theater producers who have their shows out on the road and – sometimes it's the best deal and sometimes it's just magically like fits right, mm-hmm. in the tour schedule when it can hit Indianapolis or anywhere in the region.
Excellent. Great. Yeah. Well, Matt, it's always a pleasure chatting with you and always fun to see what Broadway in Indianapolis brings here. I know I always enjoy the shows and love seeing a bit of Broadway here in Indy. So a great season you got coming up.
Great. Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Matthew Porter. The Broadway in Indianapolis season information, along with the upcoming productions of Beauty and the Beast and Dirty Dancing, is available at indianapolis.broadway.com. Indianapolis.broadway.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
There is this persistent rumor about Art of the Matter bobblehead pledge premium.
Yeah, I know. I've heard it before myself.
You know, it's just not true.
It's not? Are you sure? See,
no,
I keep on thinking if we say it enough, it will become true.
If enough of our fabulous loyal listeners call in their pledge and say, we're pledging because of the Art of the Matter and we need bobbleheads.
I like it. I like it.
I see them on
Let's
dashboards.
Let's put those volunteers to work. Call in now, 1-800-233-0020. Become a member today. And when they ask you, do you want a thank you gift, say, yes, I want the Art of the Matter bobblehead. It's a dual bobblehead with Sharon on one side and myself on the other and a little microphone in between. And I think...
Which reinforces what happens when you and I are seen in public by our listeners and they say... to me, where's Travis?
And they ask me, where's Sharon? I'm like, we don't always travel together, but
we could if we had that bobblehead.
If we had a bobblehead.
you guys are very savvy, so you might have remembered that you can also go online to WFYI.org and make a safe, secure commitment where you don't even have to interact with a live human.
That's true. It's like... you know, when they made pizza ordering online so much better and easier.
I know. I love technology.
You can just pledge that way. But you will not find the Art of the Matter bobblehead online because, again,
sadly,
it doesn't actually
not
exist.
Yet.
But if you call, you never know. It could happen someday. But we are asking you to join us because Sharon and I, we're both, I mean, obviously we're the co-hosts here of Art of the Matter. We love our job and we love what we get to do with that. But we're also members and volunteers
here.
And we are asking you to join us in membership. Make a pledge, whatever's significant for you, you know, whether it's $5 a month, $10 a month, 60 bucks at one time, you know, 100 bucks at one time. I mean, who knows? But whatever you're comfortable with, now is the time. Please do join us in membership. We're really excited that we've been on the air now for 15 years, and that is because of...
That's because of you.
Because of you.
That's pretty cool. Voted with your ears and said, this is a program we like. We tune in regularly. We find out about all sorts of crazy things we can go out and see and do. And, you know, I was listening to one of our colleagues earlier today talk about what if there were a little coin slot on your dashboard.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And you put in a quarter every time you wanted to listen to a program. We don't make you do that.
No.
We come to you
absolutely free. It's kind of a cool idea, but yeah.
But it's kind of the honor system. So you know how to do it. You've used a phone before, 1-800-233-0020 or...
WFYI.org. And after you've done that, then you can figure out what you're doing with the rest of the weekend and the week on the calendar that we call
What'll We Do? Well, last week we talked about finishing your taxes and celebrating that.
This weekend, I am all about the plans, Sharon. It's all about the plans because there is so much going on at the IMA.
You're going to Perennial Premiere.
Perennial Premiere.
Awesome.
Right, going on Saturday and on Sunday. 12 to 5 Saturday, 12 to 4 on Sunday. And that's at the IMA where they're going to have so many beautiful perennials for sale and to look at. And
I have a testimonial. Yeah? I've gone for several years in a row. I can't resist. I buy a few plants every year and they are going strong. These are very high quality plants.
They are hardy. And then I'm also going to swing by Garfield Park for the Spring Orchid Show, which is both Saturday and Sunday as well. 10 to 5 both days. You can look at some award-winning orchids that are amazing, and they will have orchids for sale as well.
Nice.
Yes. I'm looking forward to that. So it's plants for me all weekend.
I see that. And then is it you or Michelle who's planting them when you get them home?
She's getting the perennials. I'm getting the orchids.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Fabulous. If you want to see something indoors that doesn't necessarily involve plants, don't forget that at the Indiana History Center, a very popular exhibit, You Are There, That Ayers Look. If you're old enough to have lived in Indianapolis when Ayers stores were still open, you may remember they had a very long-running advertising campaign about that Ayers look. It was this wonderful ad campaign that was very, very effective because if you remember the 8 floors high Ayers store, kind of like if you watch Mr. Selfridge on our sister station TV20, a lot of the principles that Selfridge brought to department stores also were employed at the old Ayers stores, especially at the flagship store downtown in what is now Carson's. But there were 8 floors, and several of them were devoted to different kinds of ladies' clothing. And You Are There, That Ayers Look is a wonderful trip back in time. You can also see the L.S. Ayers clock on display, which is
a
beautiful landmark in our town. Very cool.
Coming up next weekend at Clues Memorial Hall on Friday the 24th, 7 p.m., it's an evening that is promoting Alzheimer's caregiving presented by Life in the Moment. And you can join the family of country legend Glenn Campbell for a very special presentation of a documentary titled I'll Be Me. And then there'll be an appearance by the director and then a live concert after the screening of the movie featuring bluegrass artists Ashley and Shannon Campbell. And this is all at Clues Hall next Friday night at 7 p.m.
And here's a cool special event coming up at the IMA. It's an Art Prize Talk with Anila Aga and Kevin Bust, moderated by our own, you know this guy, Travis DiNicola.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
coming up on Wednesday the 22nd at 7 p.m. in the Toby. Anila Aga, if you're thinking, oh, why do I know that name? She won Art Prize up in Grand Rapids last year. And with an absolutely stunning installation, and you'll learn more about it as well as about her fascinating philosophy at this talk Wednesday, April 27th at the Toby at the IMA, 7 p.m.
Very good.
And you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide.
And you can learn more if you want to listen to us next week on that calendar that we call
What do we do? But we can't do what we do without your support.
No, that calendar is made possible by members like you
exactly.
who call in at 1-800-233-0020 or log on to
WFYI.org. And any amount that you can give helps. Seriously, this is a service that you buy, but it's on the honor system. We don't come to your house and collect money from you. You get to choose how you'd like to support us and at what level.
And it's so important that if you like Art of the Matter, you actually call in or log on during our show, because they keep track of that. And they know that people are actually listening when they become members or renew their membership during Art of the Matter. And that really helps keep us on the air. That's part of the reason we've been on for 15 years doing the show, while why WFYI still lets us do it. Thank you for your membership in doing that.
Absolutely, absolutely. 1-800-233-0020 is one easy way to do it. You'll talk to some very lovely people on the other end of the phone. Or you can go to WFYI.org. It's safe, secure. You can multitask while you do it. But don't get confused and add too many extra zeros to your pledge amount.
And thank you for your membership.
Absolutely. Thanks.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
If you ever went to an older relative's home for a holiday gathering and had to help polish the silver, well, you'll love the next Lily House exhibit at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. It's called Tiffany, Gorham, and the Height of American Silver, 1840 to 1930. Sharon Gamble spoke with the exhibition's curator, Charles Venable. Dr. Venable is also the IMA's CEO.
So I hate to... Okay, I'm going to go for the pun. Tarnish the conversation about silver with politics, but there was a law enacted in 1842 that changed how Americans dealt with silver, interacted with silver, however you would put it. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's very true. And the first big change was that it really changed how Americans made silver and how we were able to buy silver and the price at which we were able to buy silver articles. And that was the tariff of 1842 that the great senator, then senator from Kentucky, Henry Clay, pushed through Congress. And it was a big protectionist move on the part of the young United States in the early 19th century to protect its baby industries, if you will. And so most of the silver that was consumed early in the 19th century in the United States was actually foreign-made, particularly English silver poured into the country and filled up jewelry stores, and Americans bought a lot of English silver. There wasn't nearly as much really coming from the American, small American shops, whereas with the passage of this tariff, it meant 30% tax was put on every imported piece of silver, which made the price jump up very, very quickly. And it gave an opening for Americans to say, well, I can fill that void of European silver that's now too expensive. And so you saw the rise of major American companies over the next 60 years. And the two we're focusing on in this beautiful exhibition is the famous firm of Tiffany & Company, and then their arch rival, the Gorham Manufacturing Company of Rhode Island.
I want to talk more about those companies in a moment. But were we, as a young country, were people buying their silver from essentially back home where they immigrated from, or was there just a belief that because Europeans had been working in silver longer, their work was better in some way?
Well, most of the market probably wasn't from new immigrants coming in, as opposed to, you know, people who had been born in the United States and had grown up here and were making a living here for a long time. But also we were a young country, and so it was really the upper class initially that could only afford silver throughout the 19th century as the price of silver as a raw material got cheaper. And as we became better and better at making it more efficiently, the price of silver objects in many ways dropped. So you had a much broader audience from, you know, pretty much lower middle class, if you want to talk about finances, all the way up to the ultra-rich in this country. And there was a mystique early on about maybe things made in Europe were better, but increasingly the American manufacturers got so good at it that quickly died. died away, and people were very happy to buy things made in the United States.
Hmm. You know, many of our listeners are probably avid consumers of Downton Abbey, and the thought of silver brings to mind the servants polishing the silver and that ritual. Silver has a strong place in rituals of American culture, right?
It absolutely does. It also has a strong place in our minds, because, you know, in the world of Downton Abbey, silver is, you could also melt it all down. You know, it's a precious metal, so if you ever had to get your money out of it, in theory, you could melt it down, or you could take it and refashion it into something in a new style. So in a way, silver could be transformed into other things of value if you wanted to. But the Downton Abbey dinner scenes are really amazing to watch, where you just see this world of paid servants and guests, and this almost ballet of objects, many of which are made of silver in those scenes, and then the rituals of etiquette that surround them all, knowing exactly which fork to pick up for what course, knowing exactly how to pass food on a silver tray or serve water from a water pitcher made of silver if you're a servant. It's really quite extraordinary to think how complicated lives were with all of these social etiquette rules and rules of behavior that really now, while they exist, they're nowhere near as elaborate or as complicated as they were 100, 150 years ago.
People won't scowl at you if you don't know your oyster fork from your salad fork.
Correct.
In most
now,
circles.
Now, you know, my daughter would look at her table and wouldn't even know those things were supposed to exist. You know, 25 and very well educated, but it's totally true. One of the things that's most fascinating in this exhibition, I think, to the public is we pulled maybe, I don't know, 50 different types of knives, forks, and spoons, and other various utensils from one set of silver flatware. So it's all in the same pattern.
Oh, my gosh.
And we've numbered them all, and then you don't immediately get to know the answer, so people are guessing in their minds when I'm in there and kind of playing with each other, saying, well, what is that for? Is that a fork to pick up lettuce, or is this one to pick up shrimp, or whatever? And then you go over to a little pocket on the wall, and you can pull the index out, and you can see what all the things were and how much you were right or wrong.
Oh, how fun. I love that. So you, earlier in your curatorial career, got really interested in silver. What drew you to silver and caused you to research and write Silver in America, 1840 to 1940, A Century of Splendor, your award-winning book? What drew you to that?
What led me to do that was, I guess I always liked silver, but I wasn't, you know, I had a grandmother who liked to have Sunday dinners and at Christmas time and other holidays. You know, she'd set the table fairly lavishly, as, you know, within the confines of the milieu of my family anyway. And then, so I enjoyed that, but I wasn't really, you know, transfixed on silver until I really went to do my master's degree at a place called Winterthur Museum and Gardens in Delaware. And that collection has six or seven hundred pieces of silver in it, and one of the courses I took required us to literally pick up and study every single one of those objects pretty much in a semester. So I got this kind of deep dive into silver and became fascinated as much by how it was made as I am by how it looks. And so when I had to pick out a PhD dissertation topic at the Boston University, where I studied next, I was very intrigued by the interplay of industrial history and labor history with fancy luxury goods like silver. So I ended up doing this study, my dissertation, on the growth of the American silverware industry, and that's actually what I re-edited to become Silver in America, which became a book that got published.
Okay. So what has tell us about the craft of silver. What has changed in how silver is worked with, how it's formed, how it's fashioned over that century or so?
Well, and the exhibition actually goes a long way to help answer that question with real objects. So when our listeners come and see the show, they'll be able to see this through objects on their own. But certainly there are certain types of silver that are manufactured just like, let's say, the ancient Greeks and Romans did, casting of silver in molds when you melt it and make it molten like a metal liquid and you pour it into molds. That kind of stuff is done very similarly the way that an ancient silversmith would have done thousands of years ago. The same is true of shaping flat a sheet of silver into a you know, into a pitcher or into a vase, something that is not flat anymore. A lot of that work's done by hammering, and that was done thousands of years ago, too. That said, in the 19th century, particularly into the 20th century, some new technology came along to really transform the way silver was made and also helped to make it cheaper so more and more people could buy it and use it in their homes. The advent of electroplating, which we all, you know, if you like silver, you know what electroplate probably is. It's where you take a cheap metal like nickel or something, and then through a process using electricity, you actually can transfer a thin coating of silver onto the surface of that object. So that started out in the 1840s in England, and America basically stole all the technology. I may be so bold and
go,
brought it back to our factory. And so we've kind of reinvested, hired people who knew how to do that in England and brought them over and reverse engineered all the processes until we could do it too. And we became some of the biggest producers of electroplate in the world. And so there were types of technology like that we highlight in the show using beautiful objects. But we also have video and stuff showing silver being made in the Gorham factory up in Rhode Island using industrial processes.
Cool. And there's a silver ingot that you can actually touch, right?
There is. It's one of the – most of the silver, of course, you don't want it to tarnish, so we have it inside of cases, but we have a silver ingot all stamped with how pure it is and what factory it came from. All of our visitors, we encourage them to touch it, in fact.
So Tiffany & Company and Gorham Manufacturing became kind of these arch rivals, kind of the Android and the Apple phones, if you will.
Correct.
I assume that there were designers who were sort of superstars and maybe these companies hired them away from one another. Did that happen?
It certainly did happen amongst a whole group of the best American silver companies. There absolutely are known cases of where Tiffany, for example, they didn't steal this person from Gorham, but they stole it from another nice, a very good company called the Whiting Manufacturing Company. And there was a young designer named Charles Osborne there who was becoming, you know, well-known in the industry for producing these extraordinary designs. And all of a sudden, Whiting started to really be seen as this sexy brand, like a great pair of, you know, I don't know, Gloria Vanderbilt jeans or something in the 19th century. And so instead of really competing long-term with Whiting, Tiffany just went and paid him more and hired him away. So he came to their studio and began doing similar designs for them. And then Whiting never really was able to replace him, so their designs got a little more boring after that, whereas Tiffany got the new hot designer who worked for them for many years and then ironically was hired away again and went back to his original company, Whiting. So there was a competition for the best labor and silversmiths as well as the best designers in between these firms.
This exhibition covers a lot of different styles. Do you have a favorite period or a favorite style?
Since I got to be the curator for this show, which I'm very grateful for because I sit in way too many meetings rather than doing those kind of things, which I do love to do, is at the first gallery you walk into where we're explaining these two great companies and the rivalry between them in the marketplace, Tiffany versus Gorham. Everything in that gallery is illustrated by these extraordinarily beautiful objects, but they're all in one single style, which happens to be my favorite. And it's a style that was derived from looking at Japanese art, which was new and different and sexy as Japan had been opened up in the 1850s to the West, and the French and the American and the English and the rest of the sort of Western powers were vying for who could import the most material, who could do the most trade with Japan. And America was one of the main trading partners. So this room has these beautiful objects either made in and around New York for Tiffany or in and around Providence, Rhode Island for Gorham. But many of them look like Japanese objects with butterflies and grasshoppers and all kinds of little scenes on them derived from Japanese woodblocks and from Japanese books and from art objects made in Japan as well. And that taste only was popular between about 1875 and maybe as late as 1885, so less than a decade, really. But it produced some of the most extraordinary silver in the United States was done in that style.
So these are the kind of organic forms that are the predecessor of what we would know later as Art Nouveau, right?
Well, to some degree, certainly the love of naturalism looking at organic or natural things. For example, the Japanese and by extrapolation American designers working in this taste often have things like irises, which are a favorite plant in Japanese gardens. And then in the show, in the very last gallery, we have an example, a case full of Art Nouveau things, this new style coming out of France in the 1890s, 1900. So about 30, 40 years later than these Japanese things I've been talking about. But there's a beautiful coffee pot, as an example, that is all made to look like it is basically this great group of irises that have been picked in the garden. Mm. So like the lid is a total iris waiting to open. Oh. Really quite extraordinary object. So there is that link through the naturalism of Asian art and the love of natural shapes in Art Nouveau. You are correct.
We're going to all go home and look at Grandma's silver with fresh eyes after
we
see this.
Well, I would hope it probably means we all go home and take Grandma's silver out of the attic.
Yeah, or exactly.
And wonder if we really want to polish it or not. We've become very different people, usually, who don't use silver the way if our grandparents were lucky enough to be able to afford it, the way they might have used it.
Dr. Venable, thank you so much for your time. I'm eager to come see this. And I like polishing silver. I shouldn't say that publicly, but...
Well, just don't take orders or you'll be in the kitchen polishing silver. I happen to like it, too. But
it's meditative.
It is. So I hope you and everybody else comes to the Great Lily House and the gardens at the IMA and enjoy this wonderful show.
Sharon Gamble with Charles Venable. He got to go back to his curatorial roots when he organized the new exhibition, Tiffany, Gorham, and the Height of American Silver, 1840 to 1930. It's on view through January 4th of next year on the second floor of the Lily House at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and it contains more than 60 exceptional pieces of silver. Go to imamuseum.org to plan your visit.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli-Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of a pop-up art exhibit.
I'll find out about the New Harmony Project's spring doings.
And I'll chat with dance kaleidoscope dancer Mariel Greenlee about how she almost gave up dance, but was inspired by a teacher who is now a guest DK choreographer. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.